All right, hey everybody, and welcome back to Adventures in Machine Learning. Today, we've got Francois Bartrand on the panel.
Hello.
I'm Ben Wilson, and our guests today are Elena and Emily from Evidently AI.
Hi there.
When I went freelance, I was still only a few years into my development career. My first contract, I was paid $60 an hour. Due to feedback from my friends, I raised it to $120 an hour on the next contract. And due to the podcasts I was involved in and the screencasts I had made in the past, I started getting calls from people I'd never even heard of who wanted me to do development work for them because I had done that kind of work or talked about or demonstrated that kind of work in the videos and podcasts that I was making. Within a year, I was able to more than double my freelancing rates, and I had more work than I could handle. If you're thinking about freelancing or have a profitable but not busy or fulfilling freelance practice, let me show you how to do it in my Dev Heroes Accelerator. Dev Heroes aren't just people who devs admire, they're also people who deliver for clients who know, like, and trust them. Let me help you double your income and fill your slowdowns. You can learn more at devheroesaccelerator.com.
All right, so we asked you to come on to the podcast because you did something pretty cool a couple of months ago. And I got aware of it because of your involvement in the MLOps community. Last week's episode, we had Demetrios on and we were talking about what that community is like and how it brings people together that are doing cool stuff in this industry and in this space. And I noticed a couple of posts, Elena, that you had made and you had answered some people's questions. And I was in the process of writing a chapter in the book about ML engineering on this topic. And then I see that you make a post. I'm like, whoa, somebody's actually open sourcing this that is going to potentially save me weeks of work anytime I need to implement this for a customer or need to give people advice on how to do this. So it was really interesting to see that. And then I checked out the code base and got really excited and started talking about it a bit. And we're finally here to talk on the podcast about what you've built. And if you could just sum it up for the listeners about what it was that you built initially and why you built it.
Let me maybe start with a bit of a background on, because the why comes a lot from our past experiences, both me and Emily. We actually have been working in applied machine learning area like for more than 7 years, working with different companies, helping them develop solutions that optimize particular business processes with machine learning, from retail, manufacturing, telecommunications, you name it. And we've seen a lot of things that can go right and wrong with machine learning projects. And we actually were lucky to see quite some of them go to production and be used for the first time. And there are so many problems that actually became apparent only after you put these models to good use, right? So when you want them to continue to deliver the business value that they intend to, that we saw that this is completely an unaddressed problem because it's fairly new. Not many companies having models in production, especially if you look at traditional enterprises. And there is like not enough best practices yet in how you maintain these models for the long term. And we saw this as an opportunity and embarked to build this company and this open source project first that focuses on machine learning model monitoring and drift detection. And in a nutshell, right now, what we have is a Python library that helps you visualize the model performance and analyze it and evaluate it in production, detect things like data drift, model prediction drift, where the model is making errors and so on. So this is like a high level overview. And right now it is used by enterprise data scientists, like individual machine learning engineers to solve their own problem. But we have big plans into turning it into a more comprehensive machine learning model monitoring platform.
And that's something that, as I've been watching the repo and Emily's commits over the last couple of months, I've kind of seen that trajectory of like, whoa, they're making a service here. And they're integrating with all of these very popular open source frameworks of like, hey, you can make this as part of a DAG in Airflow and kick this off. So it's really exciting to see that. And I'm hearing buzz from others about that, which is really cool. So when we talk about problems in production and in people that are working in this field when they're new to it, and this is sort of a company that wants to do ML, they have a pretty good idea of a problem that they want to solve, and they've hired some data scientist or hired a consulting company to come in and build it. Most people are myopically focused on prod release as saying, hey, great, we're good to go. We have a model. It's doing predictions. We have it on a cron schedule, or it's doing real-time inference. But what is it about this drift that makes that not the case, where production release actually isn't the end of the story?
Well, let me come in there. In most cases, when you just start using your model into service, you want to make sure that everything works exactly as it worked on the historical data and you try to analyze model's performance. But together with the model performance, it's super important to make sure that the data that we use as an input for our model is still the same and still has same distribution and same properties. And data drift is a way how we can analyze the, let's say, similarity of data and compare data from the current period of time with the data from the period of time where we trained our model or made some experience. In most cases, when we analyze data drift, we compare distributions. We use the historical, we use the statistical tests to compare distribution from historical data with the current data. And well, there are many, many different ways how we can do this because, well, the input data are different. We can have categorical features, binary features, numerical features, and what's not. And there are a lot of different statistical tests that we can apply to compare distributions and see if there are some changes or everything is okay.
So if we're using something like that most data scientists are relatively familiar with, like a chaos test, and we're looking at continuous distributions, and a naive implementation that somebody might do is say, I need to just say, hey, these are effectively exactly equivalent. Have you ever seen that in real world data where things are like, hey, I have an alpha of 0.01, and if it's outside of that range, I'm saying, oh, this is data drift has occurred. Or do you see more of boundaries that are set, saying, hey, we can accept a threshold here of changes before we alert on?
Well, it's for me, it's a bit tricky there because before we actually calculate the statistical tests, we need at least figure out what window sizes we use. Because, well, when we compare the smaller windows, sometimes it's easier to detect drift. But, well, okay, I will not say that again because it's really depends on the data. But anyway, it depends on the window size, right? And when it comes to model performance analysis, it's super important whether this numerical feature we are talking about is the key feature for the model or not, because at some point we can build the model on top of a lot of like pretty weak features and this model will still perform pretty well, or vice versa, we can have features with different importance and some of them will be more important. And in most cases, I would say if I saw something like this, I would react this way, like let's stop everything and rebuild the model or dig deeper to figure out what has happened. Only if I know that this feature is super important. In most cases, I think it makes sense to analyze drift on like all features we have and see what percentage of feature are drifting and how much it affects the model.
That really reminds me of one of the first times that I attempted to build a system like this, like manually myself. I was under the wrong impression that like, hey, every feature is super important and I need to create statistical process control rules around every single feature. And this is like more than a decade ago, back when I really didn't know what I was doing. Now I just kind of don't know what I'm doing. And I had put all of these alerts and I said, oh, I need this threshold around these values. And if my distribution changes on all of these by just doing normalcy and equivalency tests and saying, oh, is this really a difference. I remember the model that I was evaluating had about 100 features, which was way too many for what that model was doing. And I had alarm fatigue after just 24 hours of turning the system on. Everything was alarming constantly because it was doing 24-hour windows. And I was panicking and coming in every morning and saying, oh, I got to retrain the model again today because features drifted. Oh, geez. And then I noticed that the performance of the model didn't change at all. Like ever, just retraining, adding another day of data. And then somebody was a little bit more experienced than me. It was like, hey, Ben, did you check what the importances are of the model? I was like, well, what do you mean? It's not a tree-based model. I can't get feature importances. And I'm like, no, the coefficients to the linear model. Check what that value is. It's like, oh, it's 1e to the negative 16. And they're like, yeah, not important, man. But this other one, that one that's a very big number to that. Make sure that that one's validated. So when we're talking about the features that are coming in and monitoring that, that's one aspect of drift that people care about or should be caring about. What about on the other side when we're running predictions and we want to make sure that we're not predicting something ridiculous over time?
From one point of view, the predictions are much much more important. So if I would see some trends or differences in distributions for models output, this would go an alarm. I mean, sometimes if, for example, we have models like linear model, which can, let's say, niche extrapolate pretty well, and we see that there are some linear trends in our input data, and we expect, for example, the model's output to be higher because some important features are higher, and this is okay from the domain area point of view, then maybe it's okay. So we're seeing some trends in the input data, in the model's output, and we kind of agree with that. But in other cases where we do not expect model's output changing and we see some changes, that can be an early signal of some potential quality decrease. Because, well, when we do not expect such changes and we see that the model's output is changing, that probably we need to intervene and figure out what has happened. It's especially important when we have our ground truth is the delay and we cannot calculate the model performance right there. We need to wait while we get the ground truth, the real values, the true labels, right? And if you already start seeing that the model's output is changing, maybe it's time to take some actions or at least try to get the ground truth faster or maybe analyze some other proxy metrics that can help to figure out whether the change in output is something that we agree with or not.
Yeah, and that becomes super important for certain applications of ML and the danger of not having that feedback for certain applications that people are trying to solve arises quite a bit depending on the application. So you think of something like, hey, we're trying to prevent or detect fraud, for instance, of transactions. We're a B2C company and customers are interfacing with us and buying products, having stuff shipped to us. And if you have a model that's trying to detect fraudulent activity, if you're not getting that feedback back to the prediction to block transactions fast enough, or even worst case scenario, you're not even looking at it at all and just assuming that, hey, this works fine. It becomes a big danger if people put faith in that model and in the data science team that's maintaining it or that built it. If all of a sudden, 3 weeks later, people are like, oh, some hackers kind of penetration tested our approach here and they found out how to defeat the model. Why didn't you guys catch that? So when you get down to situations like that, having a tool like Evidently running on those predictions and creating that surrogate test, or you're saying, are we actually detecting fraud at the same rate that we were before? Because all things being equal, you would expect that even though that is sort of an illegal activity that's happening, that there's enough bad humans out there trying to do that stuff, you would expect some sort of baseline over time. And if all of a sudden the fraud predictions start trailing off, that can be an indication of, hey, maybe somebody adapted to what we're detecting here. So Evidently can do that, right? It's monitoring that rate of prediction and saying, hey, something has changed here.
It's probably one thing that you could look at, but when it comes to that degree of criticality of use cases, you can also look for outliers and like maybe add some additional guardrails on top of it. Because when you talk about drift detection, it's more like looking at the like overall trend. So like we need to wait till some critical mass of events accumulate, right, for the statistical test to react, depending on how it is set up. So for some use cases, you would probably need like even more thoroughness in how you look at them, like outlier detection, and maybe setting up some, like human in the loop review if you fire like an alarm or like raise suspicion for one particular model decision. So it can even get even more comprehensive, like than just drift detection, but indeed looking at the model inputs, looking at the trends in model outputs and statistical changes. This is what we are doing now. We will add some more stuff, and all this is hugely important. The more important the use case is, right? The more the cost of the error, the more the revenue the model generates, or the higher the potential risk if something goes off the rails.
Yeah, and I want to bring up for people listening, another potentially very interesting, at least from what I've seen at your stuff, is that for the people listening, a really good use for Evidently. I'd like you to maybe talk about how your Evidently is this great tool for monitoring performance versus the past, but it's really, you're really just comparing two models, right? Or one model on present data and past data. And you mentioned that it has also uses for if you're even without before getting to production, how big of a use case is it to, let's say, compare between two models outright with the same data? Instead of just changing the data, you change the models, but on the same data. I'm figuring this could be really useful to compare two models and how, where they go right or wrong.
Indeed, you know, the beauty of building an open source tool is like when you put it out there, the people start using it the way they like and the way they find it useful. And even though initially, like we were looking at this monitoring and drift analysis, like in a focused on model production use, right? Then it became apparent to us and also to our users that we basically built very beautiful visual reports, which help you to compare anything to anything. And it can be like comparing two different models between each other, also analyzing the model performance, like on a test data, maybe some A/B test results. And a lot of our users say that they indeed use evidently like this. And we welcome this highly. Probably like there are even maybe more users that are using it before production simply because more people are still in the pre-production phases of machine learning. But we welcome that highly too. And yeah, that was interesting kind of like user feedback that we got. I don't have the exact numbers, but the trend that we are like getting from our users is indeed there. Yeah, many people just like the reporting functionality too.
Yeah, because I was looking at it, I was like, oh, that's really cool, but I'm not really doing a whole lot of production production stuff. So yeah, I thought that would be really cool just for the model. So that's great to see that people are using it that way.
You know, I thought about one more like use case, and we're lucky to see that happening, which is more of an exchange between like data scientists and sometimes even the business counterparts. And this is something that me and Emily experienced in our past life, right? So when you're working on some project and machine learning implementation, you have like more than one stakeholder, right? You have a data scientist, you have the business stakeholder who is engaged. And very often you need to communicate between the two and just basically explain things like, hey, the data doesn't look good, right? But when you want to communicate it, you want to show something like these are the distributions, that's how they changed, right? Can you please tell me like if this exact feature, is it actually looking the way it should? In our past life, we worked a lot with manufacturing. And for example, there we had like a lot of sensor data, which have like completely particular drift patterns. The sensor is broken, like it still doesn't fire up an alarm, it still stays within the range, but it looks completely different in terms of pattern. So like collaborating on these things is very important. And when we were building the tool, we thought that like shareability and being able to export these reports and exchange them like between data scientists and someone else is very important. And we're glad that people are saying that they're using it this way. They're just basically getting these reports and they're sending them to someone else within the team, within the company, or external clients if this is more of a consulting user. So yeah, that's also an interesting thing that we learned from our users.
Yeah, can confirm one of the most painful things for a back-end data scientist is creating visualizations that are pleasing to actually look at. And the ones that you've created for this tool, I've heard the same feedback from customers that I've worked with that are also using the tool on Databricks. And they're like, these charts are just beautiful. Like we don't have to change them. We don't have to modify them. And it gives us all of the information that we need so that they can send it to those business stakeholders as well as look at it internally on the ML team. Because a lot of people think that, oh, the visualizations for data scientists should be super complex and have all this embedded statistics written all over it and bounding boxes just hovering over stuff. And then you ask an actual data scientist and they're like, no, I don't want to look at that.
Data scientists are human too.
Yeah. Exactly. busy and hacky looking visualizations, like nobody wants to look at those. It's just what you can usually produce if you don't know how to do a nice looking visualization. Can confirm that is me as well. So when we talk about visualizations in particular, one of the things that was interesting to see in both Twitter and LinkedIn and in community posts are these stories that the two of you craft. And I wanted to touch a little bit on those because they're exceptionally clever and the messaging throughout them it stands apart from other engineering groups or people that are writing open source tooling, where it's like reading an actual story when you read through it. You tell the listeners a little bit about that process of how you do that. But more importantly, how you do that so well.
It does take a lot of time, honestly. So I don't have a hack how to do this faster. And I think that's like for us, it's always like very collaborative. And probably the fact that me and Emily have known each other for so many years helps. because sometimes like I write things like basing on some conversation that me and Emily had, you know, like 3 months ago in a coffee shop. And she mentioned something to me and I'm like saying like, hey, that's going to be like a good example for my next blog.
Yeah, I love such cases where I believe that it's super, you know, boring and nobody's actually interested in it. And I just sharing something with Elena and she says, we need to write a blog about it. And I like, what? Why? Nobody are going to read it. But Elena is always right in such cases.
But maybe to add like a bit more like general thing, we do this intentionally, right? So we believe that we are solving an important problem, which is unaddressed. But also we don't know, you know, everything on how to do this. And we want to engage community. We want to bring like more attention to what we do. We want to get feedback. And that's the reason why we do this as an open source tool. And that's the reason why we create blogs and why we also want to build a larger community around the tool that we are creating and in general, like production model aspect. Because we believe that this collaboration is something that can only work out if everyone chips in. And starting sharing what we know is the first step in that, right? But we also welcome a lot. And it's been super great to see, you know, like people who are now like doing tutorials or like they are showing how they use our tool. And we also understand like their new use cases settings. So we have very welcome contributions and we hope to see more and more down the line. So not just only share our own stories. But yeah, there is no secret sauce in how to write good blogs. It's a lot of work. And Emily does the tutorials. So I'm writing most of the words. But yeah, that still takes quite some time.
So you talked a little bit about collaboration in open source projects, and that can mean a lot of different things to software engineers that might be listening in. There are some very famous open source projects out there that have communities that range from highly collaborative and inclusive environments all the way to some of the most toxic communities that I've ever even heard of. How do you go about at this stage where you have a tool that works, that is integrated to a bunch of different systems that you can use in different ways? And how are you preparing for the potential inevitable state at which you could have 100 PRs coming in a month, and not just, you know, little one-liners that are coming in, but you could be looking down the road at 1,000 feature requests that are populating per month and a bunch of people trying to submit PRs. What are your plans for managing that open source ecosystem?
Oh, well, we have a lot of plans about it, because we actually really are waiting for the contributions and we expect to have a lot. So first of all, we prepared to it technically. We are writing the contribution guide. We are moving our roadmap into issues, so everybody will see what features are welcomed as the contributions. And we prepare some tests to make it easier for contributors to test the new features or new implementation of the existing features on their own and make sure that everything works as they expected. I believe it's somewhat a bit more complicated for visual tools, because now I do a lot of testing. So each new feature we build, we need to test it visually to make sure that everything looks nice, because, well, we like nice things, we like nice visualization. I believe everybody see it in our blogs and in our tool. So we are adding a lot of unit tests and maybe something more to make sure that things that we are building works correctly. And I believe it will make it faster. So you can expect a lot of new documentations of how to contribute, how to test, how to make the right documentation. And we are going to share it with the community really soon. Because actually we have a lot of inbounds and they are very different. I somewhat expected to get a lot of feature requests regarding the statistical tests, regarding some algorithms of data preprocessing and some data science stuff. But surprisingly, we have a lot of feature requests like, can you please add different color schemas? Yes, because people actually using it as more visual stuff. And I remember someone asked me to add yellow colors because they wanted to add it into their PowerPoint slide, and yellow fits better. And I was like, oh my God. Okay, you definitely need to do it at some point. So yes, I believe this better designed testing process with the open issues with the features, it will be much easier.
Yeah, I would call that a massive success when you're working on an open source project and people are asking for things about your end result or performance, because that means people are using it, like really using it, putting it through its paces. And with their feedback and potentially contributors who just have a different viewpoint of like, oh, yeah, I know you're testing, like a lot of people are testing this on maybe 50 features on 3 or 4 models that are running. There are organizations out there that are kicking off, you know, 30 or 40,000 models a day on their system. They're the ones that are going to be like, hey, here's a way to scale this elastically in a horizontal way with distributed computing that's doing all this stuff. So,
hey folks, it's Charles Max Wood, and I just wanted to jump on real quick and let you know that I am putting together a podcasting course. I get asked all the time. I've been coaching people for the last 6 months. How do you start a podcast? How do you put it together? What do I need in order to get it going, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I've put together the curriculum, and I did it through coaching a whole bunch of people, and now I want to share it with you. You can go check out the course. It's actually going to be a masterclass. It's going to be a 4-week masterclass where I actually walk you through the entire process of launching a terrific sounding podcast and putting together content that people want to listen to. And you can find it at podcastbootcamp.io.
Yeah, I'm actually curious. Was that any challenge? Did you kind of create this from the ground up to scale massively, or were you kind of medium scale and then, you know, either there's a certain limit or you've actually reworked some things to make it work at scale? Or is that still in the coming soon department?
It's still in the coming soon, or maybe not that soon actually. But yes, there are a lot of things related to this distributed version of Evidently. First of all, because, well, I believe a lot of open source projects starts like this. At the very beginning, we thought about this library more as about MVP, and we like say, okay, let's just write it as this and then think about it later. But very, I would say, very fast, we figured out that there are a lot of users with the bigger amount of data who tried to use it. And they said, well, we need to run it on our Hadoop cluster or on our Spark, on top of our Spark. And we want to your statistical tests works distributed. And it means for us, technically, that we need to completely rewrite it, because we cannot just like add the MapReduce, for example, version of our tests, because it will not speed up it actually. Because, well, we need not just to send it to some mapper and run it there. We need to actually parallel it, right? So it means that we need to rewrite some algorithms, and this is the huge, actually. So this is
can
why
confirm.
Now we implement yeah, it's really like you need to rewrite the entire test, and oh yeah, that's a lot of work. But we are committed to it, so we are going to really do it. And now the only way to run it on top of bigger amounts of data is to use sampling. And I personally believe it's not that bad idea, because well, when you have a lot of data, you really can perform the same analysis on top of like 2% or 10% or like 5% of your data, and you can get the same results. So we can even train models on top of like 5% of our data set and still get the good machine learning model. So why not to write, and why not to run statistical tests on top of the sample? So yes, we are going to create it. And I believe it's not the like shortest perspective, but maybe like several months and it will be there.
Yeah, no, the first step is definitely to get it to work, right? And have a lot of people use it. And then you can worry about scale instead of, you know, spending 6 extra months in the beginning to try to come up with this master architecture and then get discouraged and then it never ships.
That's true.
Yeah.
Or not that good, because it means that you write some code in the wrong way. But
yeah, I also like your approach you mentioned on your FAQ about, you know, can you add, insert a plot, you know, this new plot type to your report? And this is something I've run across in SweetViz, in that it's great to add features, but you need, and because you mentioned we may or we may not, depending on how it fits with the product. And I think that's important, you know, on your part to be the gatekeeper, to say not every feature, sure, it adds functionality, but it might break legibility, make things bloated. Because, yeah, in SweetViz, I got a lot of requests or, hey, can you add this and that? But, well, then it'll make one of the strengths, which is readability and accessibility of the reports. But if you add too much, then you just drown in too much information. So, yeah, it's great to see you're tackling that balancing act head on right off the start to not lose your initial vision of clarity in the reports.
There's still something to learn here for sure. And we definitely want to have people like customize the tool, right? We just want to make it easy for them to do it locally if they want to change or adapt something. And that's definitely going to happen. because a customization is coming like with every machine learning model. It's like almost a guaranteed feature. Mm-hmm. You would like 99% things will work for you, but then you have like 1% exactly how you should adapt it to your use case. So, but we will plan to address it like with the ease of like contribution and basically making it easy to change it on your own. And that's why being open source is probably that important too, because people can adapt it and extend it in a way that will fit their use case.
Yeah, and we believe that we need to address to different audience. So we want to make it super easy to create any report for users who are not actually that deep in code and who do not want to create their own visualizations or write their own statistical tests. Just build it as it is and analyze the results. But there are actually a lot of users who really want to use some specific tests, for example, substitute Kolmogorov-Smirnov by Anderson, which I fully support, but yeah, it depends on the case, right? So for these users, we also want to make it very comfortable and easy. And we are working on the, let's say, on the architecture that will suit both. So you should have a lot of reports out of the box without a lot of customization. Just go and get it. And you need to have a tools to customize it, to add something, to remove something. And also it should be easy and nice.
So you're talking about making a very simple API that is salient. Somebody can just... a one-liner, here's my data set, here's my prediction, evaluate this over time, as well as creating a sort of a plugin architecture for individual developers to say, well, I want this backend, or I don't want matplotlib or seaborn plots. I want to just extract the data that is used to generate this chart, and I have my own D3.js visualization that I want to run, or Vegas or something. That's fascinating. And there's not a lot of open source packages that I've seen that have that mentality coming into the stage that you're at of saying, we're looking to the future and making sure that people can use this the way that they want to. The ones that I've seen and the ones that I've interacted with and have worked with that think that way are the ones that stick around for a long time. So I think that's really good that you're approaching it that way.
Actually, there are a bit too many tools, I think, in the landscape these days. So the only way how you succeed, I think, is by being able to fit into many workflows, you know, like not just like impose, hey, that's the only way how you can do things and that's how we implemented it. But also like if you want to use another visualization tool, you can use us. If you want to use Evidently with Grafana, you can use it. If you're using MFL, perfect. Airflow works too.
Even better.
Yeah,
why not?
So we want to fit into an existing zoo of tools.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question, actually. What you've got, the Airflow and MLflow integrations on your website. Do you have anything else you're working on or that you're targeting or that people have started doing on their own?
Yes, we have a lot. Together with the HTML interactive dashboards that people are using a lot, we also have JSON reports. I'm not sure that they are that popular because in most cases people prefer to create the interactive visualizations, but we still have this JSON reports, which includes all the statistics and all the data about more visualizations. And we are working on the integrations with Grafana because it's kind of a standard for monitoring now. And we already have the separate branch published where we have some code related to this Grafana integration, but I'm still working on it. So we believe we will have it like very, very soon because we are super focused on making it easy and making it, let's say, beautiful, if we can say something related to monitoring, if we can call it like this. But yes, we are still making it to look better, and we are going to public it soon. We believe the data scientists are also humans, so we agree with you there. And we really want to have the clear examples, the very transparent APIs, and the very transparent way how we can do this or that without like the instructions is 10 or 20 steps that you need to go through to integrate something with something. I personally know that it just doesn't work. And when you see the instruction that like contains really a lot of steps, you will think twice whether you really need to do it or maybe you can do without it. So this is why we spend quite a lot of time on the API, on the documentation, on the examples. And yes, we want to make this integration with Grafana super easy.
So the JSON that you're talking about, is the intention eventually, this is more for the enterprise customers out there listening, is the intention to create sort of a Git hook or something that will trigger other events, whether it be PagerDuty alarms or anything really, like an asynchronous process that's going to generate not only the visualization, but trigger a bunch of downstream processes. Is that the intention to run that as a service in the future? Something that's fully managed?
I believe yes, because it's much more convenient when you're setting up an alarms on some other tool, then it's much easier to create the rule on top of the JSON data instead of some visualizations. And this was the idea of adding JSON together with the interactive reports. And if I'm not mistaken, it was triggered by our users, right? So if I'm not mistaken, someone asked about it and they even tried to write it themselves, but the code was in not the best state at that moment, so we decided to write it our own. Yeah, it happened. And yes.
I can maybe add a bit more color then to that, how it evolved, because at first our intention was to build like a complete service on our own, right? And we are getting there. We actually want to give everyone opportunity to run Evidently as a service for a complete monitoring workflow. But then we understood how many steps we need to get there, right? And we decided to like kind of eat it step by step. So JSON is one way how you can integrate us and already build this alerting workflow with other tools. And just like with Airflow, we already have an example. You can do it like trigger-based. If there is drift detected, you do one thing. If there is no drift detected, you do another thing, right? And it might fit into many existing workflows. But eventually, and for enterprise listeners out there, it will be probably even more complete version of a tool that you can just use as a cloud service.
Yeah, and today JSON generation is really fast. So if you had some issues with the speed of dashboard generations and try JSON, that's super fast. And I believe that there are a lot of users out there who are already using some visualization tools, and they might not want to have another one visualization tool. And for this case, JSON can serve as the input data for other visualization tools. So why not to try it?
Yeah. I mean, it really seems like a natural extension of what this direction is supporting true active learning, where you have a triggered task that's kicking off and saying, and there's a lot of companies out there that want to get into this space. Nobody wants passive retraining. It's boring. It's tedious. It involves, if you have something that's been running for months and months and months, no data scientist wants to pick up that ticket in the sprint that is, you know, 0.1 story points, where it's like, hey, for 2 hours every Monday, just check all of the running models and determine which ones need to be retrained. A lot of people would rather have, hey, why can't we just automate this? But when people look at that, what that entails, an active retraining system, most companies don't have the sprint bandwidth to do that. Like, who's going to write all the statistical tests? Who's going to write the window functions to go over the historical data? Who's going to compare that out of time validation of, hey, we made the predictions 3 weeks ago. We just got the data for ground truth today. Who's going to build that ETL and do that data munging and making sure that the correct statistical test is run and that the correct thresholds are written? So when people look at those active retraining systems, it's usually like, yeah, it'd be really cool, but we're not taking an entire quarter or 2 quarters to build this system. But with just a little bit of modification and consuming the reports from that JSON event, you could build active retraining with Evidently pretty simply.
And in this case, we're basically are the ones who are supplying like the metrics and the results of statistical tests that can serve as triggers. And also you can use it for model evaluation, right? Like against some existing baseline. But to be frank, I think right now most of the companies are not yet there. There's still a lot of like moving pieces to make this sort of systems work. And our first intention right now is maybe just to bring, you know, more awareness to the fact that you even have to maintain the models. You even have to check on them from time to time and maybe retrain them, not just like as you see fit, but in a, you know, like more intentional way. So how we see it, like even though aspiration are where you mean it, right? So like you want to have like continual learning systems. You want to like automatically like suggest a better model and like just like ask you, hey, do you want to put this into prod? But starting like with the very first like 101 steps, we should be like, hey, let's monitor our models. Let's see if they actually need to be retrained, or let's retrain them in the right way because you might actually need to update it. There is a segment where we're failing on. So let's take it step by step. But yeah, I'm with you. That's where we want to get, and we want to make it easier to live with these models in production long term.
Have you gotten any feedback from somebody who's been blown away at the fact that they didn't know that their model was falling apart?
You know, we had so many stories when people say, like, confidentially, we're like such a big company. Yeah. And I'm embarrassed to say it. But this and that happened to us. And honestly, we don't really monitor our model. It's like saying, no worries, you're not alone. We've heard this story way too many times.
Yeah, same thing here. I definitely can't name drop, but there's some extremely large companies I've worked with that, like, yeah, we've got, you know, 40 models in production. Like, cool. I'm checking on GitHub and I see that the last time that there's a commit to this repo was 18 months ago. Is the model just that awesome? Like, you've never had to change it? And they're like, well, nobody's complained. I'm like, that means nobody's using it. And then do some analysis and look at it. And they're like, wow, yeah, we should probably turn this off. I'm like, no, you should just retrain it and improve it. But also just take a look at your data. And tools like what you're building makes that process so much easier. It's not the, oh, we found out 18 months later that nobody's using our model, nobody cares. And, or the worst case is people are using our model. They have faith in it, but it's giving really bad predictions. And then people are confused about why the robots are telling us the wrong thing. So this is one way to prevent that.
Hey, folks, it's Charles Maxwood. And I just wanted to jump in here and let you know about something that I'm doing. It's free. It's out there just to help you get answers to your questions about the things that you're running into with your career. So if you have questions about how to get further ahead in your career, how to start a podcast, how to get a better job, how to get a raise, how to deal with a situation at work with your boss, or just maybe you're stuck and you don't know where to go next. You know, how do I get from junior to senior, senior to whatever's next? How do I become a speaker? How do I get to the next level? That's what I'm out here to do. So every Wednesday at 12 o'clock Mountain Time, I'm going to be doing a call, and it's going to be free, totally free. Go to devchat.tv/levelup and you can register for the call. It's using Zoom's webinar software, so it's pretty straightforward. And what we're going to be doing is I'll do 10 minutes and I'll just show you how I do some form of how I level up. And then we'll just answer questions. And it's not going to be a question and answer like, hey, what's your favorite flavor of ice cream? And then I say Rocky Road or whatever, right? Instead, what we're looking for is more along the lines of, yeah, I have this situation. How do I handle it? I'm trying to figure this thing out. How do I figure it out? I'm trying to stay current. How do I stay current? And if you have any of those kinds of questions, I'll bring you on the call. We'll ask some deeper questions. We'll make sure we get you a solid answer. And I'm really looking forward to helping some people out. There will be no sales, no selling, no nothing on these calls. It is literally just 10 minutes of training and then Q&A. So you can go check it out at devchat.tv/levelup.
You know, one thing we think a lot of is also standardization, because what we've seen is many models in production, like, you know, like a singular masterpiece of a data scientist who created it. And they all said like some sort of custom, like monitoring, like throw a couple of metrics, use the tool that they like, right? And they created like this individual workflow. But what happens like when this data scientist switches project, leaves the company, or you start having like multiple models, and each of them is monitored and or like maintained in this particular way, it becomes just unfeasible to live it like this, right? And we believe that having some sort of like standard way how you look at them, or like reports that are structured in the same way, it makes it easier to pass it over to another person in the company to maintain it long term. Because we've even heard about cases when people had to rebuild the models completely because the data scientist left and no one had a clue how the initial model was built, right? Which is also fascinating.
Been there, and earlier in my career, I was that person, unfortunately, trying to be too clever and creating something complex. And I see that quite a bit in industry of some resident genius that worked somewhere that built something custom, like they built their own version of Evidently, but they did it in such a way that if you were to strip out all of their inline comments and get rid of their, you know, their PyDoc from their code, bet that person couldn't even explain how the code worked 6 months later because it's just so complex. I'm all for the standardization. So I think it's a great product that you're working on. And I really hope that community engagement and involvement and contribution just continues to grow over time, because this is such a critical part of making ML safe and, you know, useful for people to use and to solve problems. It's one of the most important parts of it. far more than what most people are thinking about. It's like, oh, it's the algorithms, or I need to use this tooling framework to solve this problem. It's like, no, you can solve it with just SQL. Just check and watch what your SQL predictions are doing over time and check the input data, because that's what's going to make or break your project.
You know, in my mental model, like a lot of attention goes towards like this model development phase. If you just like read the blogs and like see what people are talking about. But in like pragmatic real world reality, all the attention either goes to the data and what the hell you're doing before you build the model, or to what is happening after you created the model. And the actual model building might be like a half a day exercise. And it would be sufficient for so many enterprise use cases that it would not even be the critical step.
Yeah, it's all the boring stuff that's important, not the glorious, I created the world's smartest model, genius, glory role that you would want to be working on. But yeah, it's the maintenance heroes that are most needed, I guess. But it's not as glamorous.
Well, we are all for boring use cases. I think like spending that much time in the enterprise world, we're not like dreaming of the best models that can be deployed in the like most fascinating use cases, but like the boring pragmatic stuff that is also like moving the needle for the companies, like generating value for them.
Yeah, I gotta say, I love that your website, the first thing you see is monitoring is boring in bold letters. I think that's hitting the nail on the head there.
We keep debating if we should change it, but it seems to be memorable.
Yeah,
and very true. It is boring manually looking at charts based on like analytics queries that you're hand crafting to do this. Nobody likes to do that. To have it automated for you is great.
It's like airplane maintenance, right? It's not as glorious as landing the plane or whatever, but it's pretty damn important.
All right. So getting just about up on time. So is there anything that you'd like to tell listeners about what your future plans are, or how to find out more about the product and about what it is that you're building for the future?
You know, we have lived for quite a while in the situation when basically it was like 2.5 people working on Evidently. So maybe the development phase was not like that quick, but things going to be changing soon. We expect a lot of stuff to happen and to add more functionality, more features, eventually cover this distributed dataset support, enable like more interesting statistical tests, more reports, a lot of things out there. So just stay tuned. And many people like our blogs. You can check it out if you have not, like explaining the monitoring tutorials and things around that. So we plan to double down on everything. So hopefully a lot is to come in next month.
Yep. And as attached to the posting of this episode, we'll give links to that blog and to the website and to the GitHub repo as well. Yes. All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on to do this discussion. And we wish you the best of luck in what it is that you're building, and hope to see that this becomes just super successful.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Bandwidth for this segment is provided by CacheFly, the world's fastest CDN. Deliver your content fast with CacheFly. Visit CacheFly.com to learn more.